Good evening. Greet you in Jesus' name. Thank you, Brother Brendel, for your thoughts on the runaway preacher. I'm going to talk about another runaway or two here tonight for a story. And children, if you were coming with your answer about Enoch, we're going to take that tomorrow night. So Saturday evening, we'll skip that part and go straight to our story for the evening, which is in Luke 15. The title of my sermon tonight is Prodigal Brothers. This whole chapter, Luke 15, is sort of a setup by Jesus. And so we're going to read it a little story at a time. As you know, there's three stories here, three little stories in a row. And what you should see as we start from the beginning, which was what kind of problem? Well, the problem here was that the Pharisees said, Jesus, you're associating with sinners. That's not appropriate for a rabbi. It's scandalous, in fact. And you're eating with unclean people. And so Jesus doesn't launch into an explanation. He just starts telling stories. And you'll notice here that each story is headed somewhere. He tells one story, and he tells another story, and he layers three stories on top of each other, and you'll see what happens here. So let's just follow. Luke 15, we're going to look at the first story. He spake a parable unto them, verse 3. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lose one of them, doth not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost until he find it? And when he hath found it, he layeth it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he cometh home, he calleth together his friends and neighbors, saying unto them, Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. I say unto you, that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repenteth, more than over 99 just persons which need no repentance. And so these were agrarian people. They instantly connected with the concept of having one sheep missing. This is a problem. We need to go find the sheep. But, you know, you don't feel angry at a sheep. Foolish sheep. Sheep are that way. They wander off. And you have to go find them. Of course, you're happy when you find them. And the Pharisees were nodding. Yeah, follow that. Yep. It's nice. Sheep missing. And Jesus goes right into the next story. Story number two. Verse 8. Either what woman, having 10 pieces of silver, if she lose one piece, does not light a candle and sweep the house and seek diligently till she find it? And when she hath found it, she calleth her friends and her neighbors together, saying, Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I had lost. Likewise I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth. And so here Jesus varies up the story a little bit. A woman loses a coin. Now in my opinion, my feeling about this story is that it wasn't merely that she lost 10% of her household cash at that point, because her response does not accord with that. I mean, if you just lose 10% of your money that you have on hand, you're not likely to call the neighborhood celebration together when you found the 10%. You know, I mean, of course you might, but that's not likely. I think probably there's something deeper here. She gets out the candle and the broom, and she goes to turn her house upside down and looks under everything and sweeps everything up. And when she finds it, it's a big deal. And she calls the neighbors together. And so it's very likely that this was something more than just, you know, a little bit of money. One common explanation is that it was one of the coins of her dowry, which Middle Eastern women might have worn on their persons or kept with them as something very special, like it's part of their identity, because the dowry was what was paid for you at your wedding time, and it was a symbol of the respectability of a married Jewish woman to carry that, not lose it. That would have been a very valuable thing to lose. Or maybe it was like the creditors were after her, and that tenth coin represented the last $100 that she needed to make the rent payments, or she'd get evicted and thrown into debtor's prison, like some really significant bit of money, not just any bit of money, but one that was between her and some disaster. Could have been like that. Either way, the listeners listening to Jesus' story here would have been thoroughly sympathetic. Like, wow, that's, yeah, I know, you sometimes accidentally lose things, and we're all happy when we find them again, when they're very valuable. Seemed like she was jumping up and down and running out into the street to call her friends. I suppose a modern example of this is that she would have immediately posted pictures of it on social media. I found my coin back, and it'd come over probably if she invited people over, she gave them food and drink like the culture would have, and so maybe it wasn't just about money. So now Jesus has sort of softened them up with sympathy for lost and found dramas, okay? So we're happy, we know things get lost, and then we find them. And then Jesus follows, it just seems like he goes right into the third story, and he tells a barn burner of a story that they never saw coming. They didn't see coming what was coming next. They're thinking about how nice it is to find lost things. A certain man had two sons. Now, right there, they would have settled back. Oh, this is going to be good. Two sons. We know about two sons' stories. There's always a good one and a bad one. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, Isaac and Ishmael. The Bible was full of these kind of character dramas that you have two boys, and one's good and one's bad. But what Jesus actually tells is a story about a scandalously rebellious boy, a profligate son, who's received back by the father. Well, that would have been a little bit of a stretch for the Pharisees. You know, well, he was pretty bad. So a nice father, but they would have probably listened and thought, well, that was a nice Jewish father. I mean, that was a long stretch of his compassion, but they would have admired it. But they still didn't see the punchline coming. They didn't see what came next, because they didn't see that Jesus had these three stories in a row to have, he was driving at one thing, the story of the older brother. And the image of an older brother pacing around out in the barnyard. You know, you get to the end of the story and it doesn't say, and Jesus said unto them, do you understand what I mean? Or, and the people ask him privately in the house what he meant by that parable. You hear that in other parables. Here, you just get the idea. I picture at the end of this story, which we're going to read next year, I picture it a little bit like it was at the time of the stoning of the adulterous woman, where Jesus said, well, if you're innocent, start throwing rocks in. And it says they quietly slipped away from the oldest to the youngest. I picture that at the end of this story about the older brother, these Pharisees were just kind of melting away down the side streets and disappearing probably. But let's read the story. A certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And when he came to himself, he said, how many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. I am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father said to his servants, bring forth the best robe and put it on him, put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Bring hither the fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. I'm just going to stop there a little bit and think about the younger prodigal. This was unusual for him to go, "Dad, I want my share." Because Dad wasn't dead yet. I mean, this was an inheritance situation, and it had to be inconvenient. And so the first thing we see here is that a self-centered son cares very little for the feelings of his family. I mean, this was to demand the inheritance was a problem, because this was obviously a farmer. What does a farmer have to give away when it's time to divide the inheritance? Well, land, right? Well, how handy is it to split up the farm because the one boy wants his share? Well, that was unhandy. They had to liquidate the land, split up the family farm. It probably irritated the older brother because he was the other farmer. And remember, as an older brother, he got the double portion by Jewish inheritance laws. And so the farm had to be split in thirds. And two shares went to the older brother and one share to this younger prodigal who wanted to have it in cash. I want the cash. Because cash, then as now, gives you the most power to do what you want to do. If you have money, you can do things. And money still works that way. A young man with 50 or 100,000 in a bank account is still a disaster waiting to happen today, just like it was back then. I don't know what the land was worth for him. He didn't care about dishonor to his family. No doubt that the neighbors were disapproving. You hear about John's boy? Yeah, he ran away from home. Yeah, he said he made the dad split up the farm and he took his share. And oh, I mentioned the neighbors clucked about that and talked about that for months. And I'm sure that the father was well mortified about his boy, don't you think? It was a neighborhood embarrassment. And we don't know about the mother here, but Proverbs says a foolish son is the heaviness of his mother. And so I'm sure that there was a sad mother somewhere in the picture. Well, what happens? He goes off with a pocket full of cash and he begins to live it up. But it doesn't last, does it? He runs out, as it does. And so the party always ends sooner than you think. There's no endless riotous living for anybody ever. And, you know, how do we understand the story? Well, riotous living doesn't even need much explanation, right? I mean, it says what he did. It was food and drink and harlots. And so the old saying in the past centuries was wine, women, and song. And he was living it up. And in our American streets and in our colleges and clubs in America today, it might be more like drugs, alcohol, and music, and parties, and fornication. And he was living it up. But you know, the money runs out. The law gets your driver's license. Child support keeps you shackled. Your health goes down the drain. And your friends disappear. Have you seen these kind of young men on American city streets? Yes. Their health is gone. Their money is gone. Their driver's license is gone. Their friends are gone. And they're truly at the bottom of the end of the street. I remember a neighbor boy, Joe, that I went to school with. Played with. He was a young boy about my age, a little bit older. And I got to see him as a teenager make this descent, except he didn't have any money to spend. They were from a poor family anyway. But he tried his best. I think he probably bummed the money off of his friends. But I firsthand got to see him going from a boy that I went to school with and saw his decline and his descent through his teen years. And they lived right across the road from us in an old farmhouse. And eventually his mother moved away and others moved away. And the Mennonite landlord who owned the farmhouse tried to get this boy to leave. And he wouldn't leave. And he was the owner was too nice to have him evicted. And I watched him there. I watched him go down and downhill and run out of money. And the time came when his car was repossessed, and then he couldn't go anywhere, and he lost his license. And I watched as the house went to wreck and ruin. Sometimes we get over there, and a cold winter Pennsylvania winters where there was no heat in the house because the power was disconnected because it was at the bottom of everything. And I came over there, and he had pulled off almost all the trim in the house and broken it up to throw in the wood stove to stay warm. And the stair banisters went next and so forth because he had nothing left. And he was a perfectly bright, healthy, had been 19, 20-year-old that could have worked and had all the things he needed. But downhill, I remember the kitchen and his bedroom was about this deep in trash and in Tony's box pizza, as I remember, because that was the only thing he could eat. And then he would sneak into the Mennonite neighbor's shed where there was a freezer, and he would come in with and try to chaw open packs of green beans and things because he was hungry. And I remember in his bedroom stumbling over these pans of hangover vomit that I was just so appalled at. Like, to me, as a somewhat sheltered young man from a Christian home, I just couldn't believe all of this. This was my friend I went to school with. And he was at the end of it. And I remember one day specifically seeing him on a cold winter day. He had hauled out his old 10-speed bike out of the shop and aired up the tires. And it only worked in 10th gear anymore. And he was laboring up the hill to town because that's all he had to go. Well, you know these stories. And he would say, "Well, I'll change my ways sometime." So boys like that end in the pig pen. Runaway boys run from dad's guidance to the devil's bondage. So he joined himself to a citizen, it says. I think we could read this. This was a citizen of a far country. It wasn't home where he belonged. Sometimes people say this is a type of the devil, of Satan, and it could be. He was in bondage to him, some kind of selling himself as a deal. He traded his identity as a Jewish boy, you can't take care of pigs, to a Gentile farmer. In exchange for what? Well, bare survival. It wasn't even that great because he was so hungry that he wanted to eat pig feed. And he was barely surviving. No song and dance left now. No parties. He was ill-clad. We know that because when he got home, the dad wanted to right away put some right clothes on him. And I remember specifically, I love the painting that the Dutch painter Rembrandt painted of the prodigal son coming back to his father, and he's falling down in front of his father, and he portrayed him with one shoe missing. And I've always thought that's so evocative. You know, if you see a grown man going down the streets of Lebanon in cold weather and he has one shoe off, he's one shoe missing, that's a man at the end of his rope. There's just something very striking about that image that if you go around with one shoe missing, you're really at the end of things. And it was. He got home and his dad wanted to put some right clothes on him and shoes and things. He was a sorry boy. He was in bondage. And Jesus said, if you commit sin, if you're indulging in sin, you're going to be enslaved by the sin. And how many addicts have you met who have testified to that shackle? That, I'd like to stop, but I can't. Alcohol, vices, pornography, gambling, meth, whatever it is, they're so shackled by it. And it's just an irony that how many boys run away from dad's supervision or the church's guidelines or something, and before long they're shackled by the sins of addiction, the chains of addiction, or the law, or the bondage of tangled relationships. Well, the good news is, there's good news here. Every enslaved prodigal in the hog pen can start the journey back to freedom. Always. We're not Calvinists who believe in total depravity, that when you're in the hog pen, you can't even help yourself out unless God elects to pull you out and you can't do anything about it. No. He was a kind of insane here. It says when he came to him, when he came to himself. So sin is always a kind of insanity because it's a sort of deception. You're out of your right mind. We say sometimes when we watch a perfectly respectable Christian father or church leader or someone who just falls catastrophically in some kind of moral failure or something, or for some adulterous fling to throw away his whole family and his career and his business and his leadership and everything for one trade-off, and we say something, what was he thinking? What was she thinking? These things happen. And, well, they weren't thinking. That's the insanity of sin. But we don't believe that you can't think. You can come to yourself, and he says, this is a mess. I'm disgusting. I need to go back home to mom and dad. And he does. He has a little plan here. He heads back. He's not quite right. His plan isn't quite right. You know what's wrong with his plan? He says, I'm going to go home. And it sounds very noble. I don't want to be a dad's son anymore because I've blown that. I'll just be a servant. And that sounds pretty good, but it didn't work when he got home. And it didn't work because he was sort of thinking, in his plan was, that I'm going to go be a servant. What does that mean? Well, I'm going to work for dad, sort of as in an employment. And what would that be for? Well, to help pay back the inheritance I blew, right? He's thinking about paying back what he blew. But he goes home, and to his surprise, or maybe not, we don't know, he's far from the house yet when he sees a familiar figure running to him. The Father, our Father is always watching the road for our return. It was read earlier. He's not willing that any should perish. How many fathers have waited? How many mothers have wept and prayed and watched the road for a prodigal to come back? Now, there's a little difference here between this Father and our Heavenly Father. When we have prodigal sons and we're waiting for them to come back, you know what's part of the special pain of that waiting for an earthly father and mother? Is the inside gnawing fear or maybe knowledge that I was partly to blame. I failed my son or my daughter. That's how many parents have felt the pain of a child who runs away. But the Heavenly Father doesn't, of course. He still watches the road. David, he knew Absalom was a bad boy. He knew that, and he knew things weren't going right, and he's chewing on his fingernails, he's watching the road, he's listening to the messengers, and he asks everyone, is the young man safe? What's happened to Absalom? And when the rather breezy report came up, he's dead, just, you know, like all the enemies, and David, he was smitten, it says he went and he wept, and you know how it says it there in Samuel, oh, Absalom, my son, would God I had died for you! My son. Well, in David's case, what do you think David was thinking? Oh, he had plenty to think about. He had plenty of pain to turn over in his mind. What kind of example had he left Absalom? Yeah, all manner of failure. And I'm sure that in the days that he was watching the road for Absalom and waited in Jerusalem all those years, waited for Absalom to meet with him after they had been estranged for a while, I'm sure David had a lot of time to think about his failures. Well, you know, we're earthly parents. When our children are teenagers, we sit up and wait for them to come home, even if they're not prodigals, right? I had an experience like that when I was wanting to fly up here for this week of meetings on Monday morning. My son was in New York, and he was driving home through the night. I knew he'd be driving through the night and would get there sometime early in the morning. I wasn't too thrilled with that, but he thought that was fine. And he hasn't taken a lot of interstate trips, and I didn't sleep well. I was probably also thinking about trying to get up and make my airport, but I didn't sleep well. And about 3:30 in the morning, I was wide awake, and I was listening. I don't think he's home yet. And I started praying. Just pray, Lord, that he'd stay awake. Anything would happen, you know. And while I was doing that, I felt like I heard a clear voice from God to me. He said, you're just worrying that he doesn't fall asleep? You should pray for the people who have sons out there that they don't know where they are spiritually, or prodigal sons. They're worried about a lot more than them falling asleep. And I did. I thought of fathers and people that I knew who had that. And as I was doing that, I heard the sound of a vehicle coming in the lane. And a little later, I heard the door open quietly. And I don't know, it was like a time where my testimony is that God woke me up to tell me that. And if you have If some of you have sons like that or children like that, or you know people who do, it's your calling to intercede. It's your calling to intercede for the fathers and mothers that are watching the road. Well, comment on my his plan. He gets home and he says, "Well, I'm gonna be your servant," and the father seems to cut him off. He says, "No." He doesn't even explain. He just says, "Hey, servants, let's have robes. This is wonderful." So the lesson there to think about, though, the reason I said that the son had a bad plan is that we can't pay for salvation or forgiveness. You can't work it off. You can't repay. Grace, Paul says, not of works, lest any man should boast. And the forgiveness really wasn't just, "Okay, son, I'll forgive you for that." It wasn't even that. He signaled his forgiveness by like the exceeding great gift that Paul talks about. "Come on, bring the robes and the rings and the shoes, and we're not going to have servants' food here, potatoes and rice. We're going to have steaks. We're going to celebrate. Bring the musicians. Let's have a party here." And so it exceeds what we expect restoration does. Well, let's go to the older prodigal. Let's finish the story. Verse 25. "Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said unto him, 'Thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound.' And he was angry, and would not go in. Therefore came his father out and entreated him. And he answering said to his father, 'Lo, these many years did I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. As soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf.' And he said unto him, 'Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. It was meet that we should make merry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead, and is alive again, and was lost and is found.'" So here you have a diligent, self-righteous, respectable son, but he's skeptical of redemption possibilities. You know, he was out in the field working where good boys should be, you know, not running around out in the pig, you know, not running out like prodigals. He was out in the field where he belonged, where the younger brother should have been too. And he wasn't like this disgraceful brat that he had for a brother. But he comes in, he hears the sound of celebration, and it's interesting that sets his suspicions on edge. And instead of going to the house and seeing what was going on, he calls the servants, "Hey, what's going on in there? Something seems out of place. Maybe it's not proper," you know, because there's one thing about older sons is they're very concerned about what's proper and what's morally right and what's respectable in the neighborhood. And to just have a party going on unplanned, there's no wedding I knew about, there's nothing I know about, what is going on in the middle of the day in the house? And he's immediately on high suspicion. Something is not right here. Well, he finds out, the truth, that boy came home. And worse than that, dad is calling apart. The calf, that prize calf, was killed, and he was angry. Well, proud and proper sons often have anger problems. In fact, in my experience, I think you can even turn it the other way around. That sometimes, if you meet someone with an anger problem, they are indeed proud and proper sons. It goes together. His father comes out, and it says, it uses the word entreat. "Please, son, don't do this. Don't make a scene. Please, just come in. This is a great time. Johnny came home. I mean, what? Don't do this." And what does he do? In spite of his father's entreaties, he blows his anger directly at dad. He takes it out on his father, wasn't his father's fault. He says, your boy, this thy son. He doesn't say my brother. He says, this thy son. And he blames him. You never gave me. I have been morally upright and a paragon of rectitude and righteousness, and therefore I am qualified to stand out here and be angry because I have been upright. Well, that's how anger works. What was he really angry about? The calf? I mean, was that what he was mad about? The calf? Well, it was his, right? It was his calf, not the father's calf. Because we know that it was all that he had. The dad said was going to be his anyway. He was the firstborn. Was he jealous of the attention? Well, maybe. I'd like to propose that the reason he was angry was because mercy messes up the ledger of a proud moralist. Mercy messes up the ledger of a proud moralist. See, the older brother lived in a world where everything has to be paid for. The ledger has to balance. You commit a sin, you get punished. You obey the rules, you get rewarded and respected. You work hard, you inherit the farm. You know, these things add up. And when a person like that encounters mercy, because you know what mercy is? Mercy is like a shortcut. The columns don't add up anymore when there's mercy. And it collapses their world because such a moralist, such a proper son, has staked his whole self-worth on right performance. He staked it all on there. And when he sees that someone else, this son, did so badly, and he's accepted, well, what's the use of my years of obedience and work on dad's farm if the bad boy gets the same prize? It's like the story of the parables. You know, the ones they started working in the morning, they worked all day, and the other ones came, squeaked in right at the end and worked a little bit before 5 o'clock, and then they lined up for their pay, and they started saying, hey, wait, he got the same amount I did? What? That's not fair. It's the same problem. You know what the answer was? The answer was what the father said. He said, son, which is interesting because he claims him, his son, everything I have is yours. Now, think about that. He wasn't actually saying, you're going to inherit all this anyway, calm down. That's not what he was saying. He was saying, everything you have I gave you, son. You didn't earn any of this more than your brother did. I gave it to you. See, elder brothers think they pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, and they don't see the benevolence of the Father. And so it's a very self-centered view. And I would propose the elder brother's even more self-centered than the prodigal, because at least the prodigal was humble. The prodigal never bragged that he had done anything special by himself. He was humble enough because he didn't think he was a self-made man. Well, the prodigal problem, as we said the other night, runs in the family, doesn't it? You could be a prodigal son, the younger one, or you could be the prodigal older brother, I suppose. But I really think we're a lot more complex than one type, right? We don't just fall into that some of us are like this and some of us are like that. We're more complicated than that. And so think about it like this. Both sons wanted control. Both of them, the younger one wanted dad's money so that he could control his experiences in life. The older one thought that he could control by his obedience and moral rightness, that he would have respectability and he could always intimidate dad and the younger brother by his own sparkling reputation. Point out other people's failures. Did you ever meet anybody like that who wields power over other people in the church or in the workplace and so forth because they are Mr. Right and they do things right and they like to point out how you and you and you are doing things wrong? Well, that's a certain kind of control. It's a certain kind of power that comes from that striving after performance. Both boys were after dad's money and not his love. Both, at first at least, resented their father. and rebelled. But one found redemption, one fell down and was brought into the house where it was bright and there was joy and dancing. The other one stayed outside. I picture it like it was probably nighttime by that time in the evening, and it was dark outside, and he was stalking back and forth in the barnyard somewhere, fuming to himself, looking at the lights of the house and listening to all the party noise in there, and just wallowing in his self-pity. Oh, I've lived so carefully, and look at that. Well, why isn't there a third boy in this family? You ever wish that? You know, it's kind of a bad boy who repented, and then a really bad older brother. I mean, why can't there have been a third boy? One who stayed home and listened to father and was kind and obedient and compassionate and did everything right. Maybe that would have been too easy, and Jesus was just wanting us to see ourselves in one of these boys. I'm not sure. I would say in conclusion to youth especially now, if you're chafing under your parents or your church, secretly longing to run out and have a little more latitude, I would ask you to think of this, that this story, that the path from mom and dad's table to the pigsty is always shorter than you think. It's always shorter than you think. And before you run anywhere, young men, young ladies, before you run anywhere, read Proverbs 4 and 7 and Luke 15. And if you're an older person and you have worked in father's fields very respectably for many years, and you feel kind of impatient about these young ones who run off and who don't seem to get it, and they're immature and they're selfish and they're willful and so on, and you feel irritated by the failures of other brothers in church and so forth, then your job is to read Romans 5 to 8. These are answers to the prodigal problems. Let's stand for prayer.